Hotter Than Ever is brought to you by Broad Collective, a membership network for professional women pivoting to self-employment in midlife. Maybe you've been dreaming of starting your own business, or you already work for yourself. In Broad Collective, you'll find the strategy, peer support, tools, and practical resources you need to take ownership over your career, connect with your target audience, scale your business, and grow your income doing the work you love. Creating meaningful content is the best way to get the word out about who you are and what you do. But most solopreneurs don't have a strategy for how to use social media, AI, podcasting, newsletters, self-publishing, public speaking, and all the other media channels available to us today to make the biggest possible impact. In Broad Collective, our members learn from each other and from experts how to turn their expertise into revenue and how to do it joyfully by leaning into our strengths. Whether you're an established entrepreneur or just starting out, as a Broad Collective member, you don't have to grow it alone. Go to broadcollective.com for more information and apply today. Welcome to Hotter Than Ever, where we uncover the unconscious rules we've been following, we break those rules, and we find a new path to being freer, happier, sexier, and more self-expressed. I'm your host, Erin Keating. Today, I talk to comedian Nagin Farsad about her experience taking a therapeutic dose of psilocybin mushrooms on an all-expenses-paid luxury trip to Jamaica with one of the premier psychedelic tourism companies. It was a gig that she got paid to write for the magazine Afar, and it turned out to be so much deeper and more impactful than she could have ever anticipated. She is so smart and so funny. I think you'll really enjoy this fun conversation. That also takes the turn for the deep and philosophical, as we like. Take a listen. Nagin Farsad is a writer, social justice comedian, director, and actor. She is also a TED fellow, which is very fancy, and her TED talk called A Highly Scientific Taxonomy of Haters, which you should definitely watch, has been seen by millions. You may know her from NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, where she's a regular, from her Thurber Prize-nominated book, How to Make White People Laugh, or from the podcast Fake the Nation, which she hosts. This is a very busy and prolific woman. Welcome to Hotter Than Ever, Nagin.
Oh my gosh. Thank you so much for that ridiculous introduction that I need to record and send to my mother as proof that I've done anything. It's fun that to like be described as prolific because, you know, you know from also being an artist that one never feels prolific. One always feels behind and they didn't write enough and they don't have any ideas. So thank you for buoying my spirit this
afternoon. Part of why I read all the credits, even though we're not even going to talk about most of that stuff, because my experience with this podcast is that the women that I talk to are so prolific, so successful, so good at what they do, and none of them are willing or able to give themselves credit. So I'm here to give you some props.
Thank you. Felt it in my soul.
Very good. So what is a social justice comedian?
You know, in the early days, like when I was doing stand-up, people kept saying like, oh, you're a political comic. And I always felt like that wasn't quite right because I wasn't like doing material about Mitch McConnell or whatever. And so it felt just kind of wrong. And you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, and also I think they would always say that because I would do stuff about like my family and my parents and being Iranian. And it's not like I was doing stuff about being Iranian. It's just, I am Iranian. So it just sounds like I'm doing stuff about being Iranian. It's one of those dumb pigeonholy things where people are like, oh, you can't do too much stuff about like, you know, your family being Iranian. I'm like, yeah, but like, it's my life though. I don't know how to like avoid it too much. So people would just think it was political because any mention of a country like that sort of becomes political, even if it isn't, even if you're literally like just talking about like food or farts or whatever. And so Iranian farts are particular types of farts.
That's political. It's definitely political.
Yeah. Well, Iranian farts actually like create uranium. So, hey, come on. See, that's a political joke. All right. So I bristled at being called a political comic. And I was like, I don't think I'm quite a political comic, but I guess I'm more of a social justice comic. I just want to be on the side that is what I feel like more justice oriented. And so that's just what I started saying, and it just sort of stuck. And so I just sort of ran with it. Though interestingly, over the years, that term has gotten like, you know, these negative connotations. There's like the social justice warriors, and there's all these people that I feel like maybe more annoying.
Professional funny person is really what you are, and you have a point of view about what's going on in the world.
Yeah.
And you share it, and you happen to be
right.
Iranian American, and that gives it a certain flavor or tinge.
Yes.
To the mainstream. Yes. When it's actually just your life.
Yes. Yes. And that flavor is saffron.
Amazing. So stupid. It's delicious and very expensive and rare.
So expensive.
So your bread and butter is being a comedian. But the reason that I reached out to you to come talk to us on this podcast is because I read this wonderful article that you wrote for Afar magazine, which is about you taking mushrooms on a psychedelic therapeutic journey. And I am interested in psychedelics and kind of this incredible burgeoning culture of psychedelics and therapeutic treatment that is all sort of bundled together now in like these lifestyle journeys. Yeah. And I'm interested in hearing your perspective because, you know, in my experience, comedians are not known for talking about feelings or therapeutic practices, unless you're Maria Bamford, without making jokes about it, right?
Yeah. I mean, definitely it was an out of my comfort zone experience. And it's funny, you mentioned that my bread and butter is comedy. So part of the reason the magazine sent me there is because they wanted someone with like a comedian hat on to go and have that little suspicious, you know, viewpoint on the entire process. And I'm someone who fit the description because I absolutely had never done mushrooms before. I'm just generally like not a drug person. I like obtained an amount of mescaline once and then ended up like selling it randomly. I was a drug dealer for 5 minutes.
To take it.
Because I was too scared to take it. I tried to be like a weed person during a breakup because I was like crying too much. And everyone's like, do a bunch of weed. And I was like, that sounds like a great idea. I'm going to do that. And I obtained an amount, like whatever tablespoon of weed, however weed comes. And I watched a bunch of like YouTube tutorials on how best
like
to roll.
How to get
I was
high.
Like a very
great.
Yes. I was like a very good student of weed. And then I did it a couple times and I was like, oh, this is great. Like, I am not crying. But then I would like forget to do it. And I was like, how do people set timers? Like, how do you get into being like a weed person? So I've basically never achieved full drug usage in my life. And so
got it.
For me to go to this thing was really like outside of my comfort zone, but I did feel a weird draw because it had been it's been in the zeitgeist, right? A lot of people are talking about it. A lot of my friends have talked about it, like having great experiences and stuff like that. And it felt like, oh, okay, I am curious. And maybe, you know, I think I felt like a weird creative sort of rut adjacent feeling.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I just thought maybe mushrooms, they're the answer. And of course, it was a job. You know, and when you're a comedian, you just kind of take gigs. And, you know, and I know that my parents came here with nothing and this promise of America, and they would work 14-hour days doing hard work. And I have joined them because I clock in and clock out at mushroom retreats doing the hard work of going on psychedelic trips. So you know what I mean? That's the kind of heavy, so I know a thing or two about hard work.
Immigrants, they get the job done. Yeah.
Yeah. But it was, you know, so in that sense, like sending a comedian, I think was the right idea, because if someone's already too into it, they're not gonna be, I think, critical enough of like what the whole thing is. Because there was a lot of jazz around it. There's a lot of like, the hype. Is it all hype? Is it, how much of it is real? How much of, you know? And so I really wanted to put a little bit of a magnifying glass on the hype to see if it really matched up to its expectations. Yeah.
And are you like a wellness, self-care, woo-woo, goop person?
No, not at all. In fact, I'm going to say something controversial, which is that I am a little like, the idea of self-care feels really anti-community to me. And I've always not disliked it, because I'm just like, I think part of the problem in this internet era is that we spend way too much thinking about ourselves. We fucking need to stop thinking about ourselves so much. And self-care is just another way to think about ourselves. Like, think about others. Let's try thinking about others and then see them in real life and feel their feelings and grapple with their problems and help and do, you know. So I'm anti, if anything, self-care.
Got it. So you're the perfect candidate to bring a skeptical point of view to what you describe as a psychedelic tourism or transformational retreat travel, which those words are so packed with promise of change and evolution and all the good things that we, in this sort of self-care, wellness, self-help universe that I sort of inadvertently weirdly find myself in, because I am a little bit a skeptic as well. Just because I talk about women and our well-being, like, and how we can be happier and hotter, like, I'm sort of in this self-help space. But I have a similar skepticism about the language of all this stuff, the business of all of this stuff. But not, I do believe that there is value. And I myself, like, when I first got divorced, went on a psilocybin weekend with some woo-woo people in the hills outside of San Diego. And I was laughing too much, and they told me that they reminded me that it was a spiritual experience. And I was like, oh, they want me to cry. Okay. so I did. I had gone there to cry and to excavate some shit.
Right.
But I also was like, can it also be a party? I don't know.
Yeah.
But I like this world. I think it's really interesting. And you went to like a luxury resort, you were very handheld through the process. Can you talk a little bit about how you prepared and who else was there and what it was like?
Well, so I went to a place called Myco Meditations, and they have a bunch of different retreat locations. And this one, they're all in Jamaica because psilocybin is legal in Jamaica, and they have a farm there, they grow their own mushrooms, and like they make the pills, they formulate them into pills, and the whole thing, it's a very elaborate, they share their data with Johns Hopkins. If you want the science of it, you go, like, Myco Meditation seems to be the gold standard for this kind of like psilocybin travel. And they made me feel, you know, even just like the intake forms and like, you know, disclosing your medical history, all that stuff really made me feel relieved, because this was the kind of retreat that was just, I mean, there were handlers and therapists, so many therapists. There were, you know, there was a nurse, you know what I mean? Facilitators. I mean, it was like, there was like, maybe one person for each 1.5 people that were there.
That's amazing.
There to make sure everything goes correctly.
Yeah, that was not the retreat I went on. Yeah.
No, this was like with an eye towards therapy and literally and medicine. And it felt right for me, the like nerd that also needs data and like kind of scientific backing. And so they were pretty serious about their intake forms. Like, if you're on a bunch of SSRIs or whatever, you take Zoloft or all those things, it doesn't work. You have to get off of those things. And they work with people for like months at a time, in advance to say, like, listen, you know, you got to get off of those things. Okay, now where are you at? So they're also, they just seem sort of like they had boundless energy for this type of process. I mean, it's, you know, look, I'm not going to lie. It's very expensive.
Yeah.
And they have different,
you know how much it
price
is?
Tiers. I mean, I think the thing I went on was something between like $10,000 and $12,000.
Yeah.
But they have versions that are like, you know, I don't know, lower, like maybe $7,000-ish or something. But, you know, so there's different kind of like levels that you can do. And it all has to do with accommodation. I mean, you get the same mushroom either way. It's like the same mushroom with like white linen cloths. That's the difference. I mean, I didn't know anything. And I did very little research going into it because I wanted to have just be surprised by everything so that I could really write this piece for a farm magazine. And there was a group therapy and I didn't know how that was going to be structured. So like, basically there was three dose days. Those are the days that you trip. And in between you have a bunch of talking and processing what happened during your trip.
Right.
So yeah. And that was interesting because we were nine perfect strangers,
like the
Hulu TV show. Mm-hmm. I was the Nicole Kidman character. Thanks. And,
Does your face move? Sorry. Can't help it.
Unfortunately, yes. But there was, you know, the cast of characters was incredible. This is a casting director's dream because there was a, you know, of course there was like a woo-woo kind of yogi person. There was like, you know, a tech bro type dude, there was like a gay pharmacist. There was, you know, a full on Hasidic Jew wouldn't shake hands with a woman, you know what I mean? Like that level, serious practicing, you know, and then there was me, like the Muslim comedian, like, so we were just an extremely varied group of people.
That's so cool.
And then it was really cool. It was also just really unexpected. I didn't know that Hasidic Jews were like super fine with psychedelics. You know what I mean?
Right.
For example. And also we were generationally mixed. There was like, you know, younger people, older people. Like it was a very interesting mixed group. And everyone came because I had to. Like no one was there because it was going to be fun. Mm. Everyone was there because they needed to figure some shit out that had been really in the way of their own personal happiness. And they were dealing with some serious issues. I was the comedian who was there for a gig. And so like it oftentimes felt a little ridiculous, you know?
You said in your article that the retreat therapist or one of them said that mushrooms are for getting over your horse shit so you can move on with life. And I just loved the directness of that.
Yes.
That we all have some kind of horse shit that's in the way of us getting on with it and maybe moving to the next chapter or getting unstuck or resolving old stuff or, you know, forgiving someone or forgiving ourselves or unearthing trauma and working through it and getting on to the next thing. I mean, this is the horse shit of life.
Yes.
So were you conscious of any horse shit that you were going to try to work through?
I was in such a like strange position because everyone was clear on their particular form of horse shit. I just kind of thought mine was about being a comedian in an unforgiving industry. And what it, you know, and how it's like a constant nightmare that you just like deal, you know,
waking
what I mean?
Nightmare
just all the time. No, and I exaggerate because obviously good things have happened for me, but it is very tough. It requires such a thick skin. And I thought that my being there had to do with needing to move the needle on how much I could produce. You know what I mean? Mm. Like I kind of maybe felt stuck a little bit artistically, you know, I just had vague and I'm an anxious person. I think I just had like a lot of just general anxiety. Mm-hmm. That was what I thought I was going into this with. And it turns out what I didn't realize was that I was carrying a lot of stuff. Mm. There were sort of like three areas of thing I was carrying around. And one is, you know, probably not surprising to anyone. I'm a mother. And so I had this incredible guilt over leaving my child to go do comedy. And I leave my child a lot, like way more than the average person, to go do this job, which is maybe a narcissistic and dumb job. You know what I mean? So like, oh, so I have
so
a lot of,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, right. So I have mm-hmm. a lot of guilt around that. And, mm-hmm. You know, and it's funny because like my first trip, you know, and just to give you an idea, like the first, you know, if you're doing like a party dose or something of psilocybin, you're going to do like 0.5 grams or 1 gram. We started with 3 grams. And then mm-hmm. the next time I did 6 grams, the next time I did 7 grams. So these were like ridiculous numbers
that's
of
hardcore.
Grams.
Yeah. Yeah. That's yeah. a lot of drugs.
It's a lot of drugs. but the intention is for you to like really go inside. You know what I mean? And they put you on a cot, you know, like a lounge chair type deal. They give you these masks because even though you're in like a beautiful Jamaican setting and it's warm and lovely, they don't want you to look at anything. They want you to go inside.
Every time?
Each time, all three times? That was the setup. Yeah.
So you didn't That's get to right. see like, you know, trees turn into claymation and shit?
Yeah. At the end, I did, you know, and you could like take off your mask. Like it wasn't, you know, yeah. it wasn't the Gestapo running this, but like, you know, especially at the end, I did like take it off for like the last couple of hours and just like, you know, but, yeah. but what's happening on the inside and like the worlds that you're seeing are far more therapeutic, you know, than watching a tree yeah. turn into claymation. And in that very first trip, I dealt with just all of the guilt. And I saw my daughter. I was with my daughter a bunch. My daughter would turn into my mother. My mother would turn into my daughter. It was like this confusing thing because yeah. I feel guilty for her. I feel guilty about my mom because my very presence meant that she couldn't follow her dreams. Like she grew up in this patriarchal Iranian situation. So having a child was the goal as opposed to whatever goal she may have had,
right.
you know, which was opera singing. Actually, and I saw I went to an opera. I mean, it was with her, you know,
your trip.
On my trip because of her. I was with my daughter. I kept going. She kept holding my hand and being like, don't go. And I'd be like, no, I have to go on safari. Safari was the stand-in for stand-up comedy, which would make so Amazing. Much sense because in both situations, you can be eaten by wild animals. But if you don't, then it's a really fun time.
Right. It's a revelation. Right.
Yeah, exactly. And I cried for 5 hours straight. I just cried and cried and cried. And I think I needed to let that guilt go, you know, because I think that guilt is, you know, we all know, right? You know, like rationally that kind of guilt is counterproductive. Yeah. And that's holding you back. And there's just like no need. It's just a waste of your energy. And yeah. yet your body does it.
Yeah. Right.
And I think I just needed to
And
let
moms
go.
Really corner their market on guilt, especially if we want things beyond.
Yes.
I think, you know, women who are ambitious, who have children and who also chase career or public life or an intellectual life. It is really hard to counter program against what, you know, this bombardment of messages of how we're supposed to be and what the ideal is and how what we're doing is a more male way of living life. Yeah. Like if you were a dude and you were a traveling salesman and you were away a week out of the month or 2 weeks out of the month and your wife was raising the kids, all good. But because exactly. your bread and butter and your personal drive and your ambition and your self-expression demands a certain commitment and a certain lifestyle, which is really hard, which is why a lot of women drop out of comedy in the first place.
Yes.
You know, you got to carry that load with you But maybe the trip was telling you, you don't have to feel so bad about that. Maybe that's just what it is.
Yeah. I joke in the article that all of my realizations, you can find monogrammed in throw pillows across suburbia. Like that, they're simple, dumb, like really simple realization. Don't feel guilty.
Right. You said after the first one is like, you need rest. Everyone deserves a nap.
Everyone deserves a nap. And I would like have these bolts of realization, and I would lift up my mask and I would write it down in like 45 point font, because like you have no motor skills, you know, when you're tripping. And it's funny because like I had, you know, my reputation of like, you know, aggressively grabbing hold of my notebook while I was tripping, you know what I mean? Because I was like, so no, like I'm here for work, and I'm going to need to take notes. So my realizations were really quite simple. And that day I was just like, everyone deserves a nap, and they walk you to your room because you really can't be left alone. And, I took a look at myself in the mirror and my eyes were just out of control, puffy. And I said to the nurse, like, oh my God, what happened to my face? My eyes are so puffy. And she's like, yeah, you cried a considerable amount. So like it was, even by her standards, and she'd seen it all, like this was an excessive amount of crying. And it's funny. So then by the time I went into my second trip, I was like, I felt very nervous about the whole thing because that first trip was so challenging. And I was like, oh, is this just going to be hard every time? Do I have to reckon with shit? I'm not here for reckoning. I'm writing a story, you know?
Yeah, I'm here to bat these things away with jokes. Right.
Yeah, exactly. And so it was like nerve-wracking to keep going on with it.
But the second one, you became Serena Williams.
Yes. The second one, I had an ego death. And I don't know if they talked about an ego death when you did your spiritual mushroom healing. So an ego death is really common in psychedelic travel. You kind of become one with nature and you literally like lose yourself. And my ego death was like, my trip was like, you gotta go be a sunset. And I was like, I'm sorry. I don't think it's gonna be possible for me. I don't know how to be a sunset. No, thank you. And the trip was like, just pick a shade of orange and get it done. Like my trip was very aggressively pushing me to become a sunset, which I did do, not to brag. I was a sunset for a while, as you know, as one is. And I came out of it, I had to like vomit out a demon, which is also apparently very common. If you're tripping, you might feel like there's like some sort of a, like a hot demon in your body. And they tell you like they've seen this so much with people that they literally were like, yeah, so we figured that, you know, we found that the best way to deal with it is just like get on your hands and knees like you're gonna retch and get the demon out. So that's what I did. A little miming, wild. A little object work, some theatrical fake vomiting.
But
I needed to. And I think that the demon in my body was self-doubt, because then after I got rid of the demon, that's when I found myself on a clay court at the French Open, and I was Serena Williams. Playing, I guess the French Open, and I don't know anything about tennis, so all of those words are basically alien to me. But those are the main tennis words, and so I know them in my subconscious. And I can't even tell you, Serena, she's 5-0 or whatever thing, but whatever it is people say about her record, I can't tell you that. I don't even know, but I just know
you just
that
know
she,
what she, represents
she symbolizes
for you,
greatness.
Or right.
Yeah.
Right. Right.
And confidence, yes.
Right? Like she seems to just be, she's has this ability to banish through incredible hard work and labor and excellence, but to banish self-doubt and to see herself as a champion, because she is one.
Right. I mean, so and it's funny because I never thought of myself of like as like thinking about sports people.
No.
But I remember when I was very pregnant, my husband was watching one of these opens and I came in the room and he was watching the thing and he was like, man, Serena Williams. And he's a sports people. So he's really all about those stats and details and whatever. And he loves like sports documentaries. And he was just telling me how great she is or whatever. And I saw a little clip and an interview of her. And I thought, I wonder what it's like to not doubt yourself. And it's funny because like now I know because I did it in this trip. And I woke up and I wrote on my notebook, everyone can be Serena Williams. Because it's a mind game, you know? We can all do that mind game. It's, you know, takes some practice, I suppose, but it's possible.
Yeah. I mean, it's so interesting to me how baked into the experience of being female, at least from the people that I have been talking to on this podcast, that self-doubt, that questioning, that how dare I, am I good enough, you know, what if I fail, et cetera, how we let that story be the dominant story as opposed to the like, well, fuck it, I'm just going to do it. Fuck it. I believe in myself. Like
yeah.
Other people should believe in me.
But also, you know,
we don't have that fuck it until midlife. That comes in my experience and in the experience of a lot of the people I've talked to. That comes as you enter your 40s, 50s, and 60s. Like we do have access to more of the fuck it. More of the like, oh, yeah, I know what I'm doing. Not the like,
that.
Oh, I have to learn everything. You know, I have to dot my I's and cross my T's and do all my homework and be much more prepared than everybody else because I have to make up for some potential deficiency that I have in this situation, which is, I think, how a lot of successful women operate. But yeah, I think there's biology to that too, from what I'm starting to understand, which is like as your estrogen drops, your desire to please people reduces.
Interesting.
So your desire and willingness to accommodate others, I heard in a recent interview, that starts to go away. And I think I cannot imagine that Serena Williams prioritizes other people over her training, over her discipline, over her
right.
work.
You right.
know, she just didn't yeah. need the estrogen drop of midlife to do that.
Yeah. 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 And I guess no one needs the estrogen drop. Like, I think you can probably figure it out.
Yeah.
It's like building, you know, it's like building a habit. I think one of the most incredible things that I sort of realized recently that I had done in terms of like habit building was just like I exercise. Mm. And I used to aggressively not exercise. And mm-hmm. then, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago, I just started like putting it in my life. And now I like can't imagine not exercising. Mm. And it's funny because like I'll hang out with my friends. We'll all be like, oh, I should exercise. And I'm always like, yeah, dudes, like exercise. What are you doing? And it's like, it's a habit. I've just built yeah. a habit. It's not like I love it, you know, or whatever. I like, of course, I love the endorphins and that's why I keep doing it. And I love the health benefit, but it's a habit. I built the habit and now I can't imagine not doing this habit.
Right.
And I think that's, you know, that kind of method of thinking and the confidence building and stuff like that. Like, you don't need a dramatic hormonal shift. Like, I think you can build
right.
it that habit.
Yeah, but we got to work at it.
Yeah,
we got to work at it. We got to find the resources in us to make that decision.
Yeah.
That like, it's good to prioritize ourselves. You know,
it's so hard, especially when you're a mom, because the whole narrative around being a mom from the beginning of time is that your children come first, and obviously they do still come first.
You got to keep them alive.
Yes. But I guess it's like, I don't know, does the come first framing help anybody? Like, of course they come first. We don't even need to talk about that. It's just like other things can also come along with it. You know what I mean?
Right. Right. And if you sell yourself out for motherhood, if you have hopes and dreams and you have aspirations and you have all kinds of things on your plate that you want to accomplish in this one very short life we get, does it benefit your kids for them to see you not doing that?
Yeah.
You know?
No, exactly.
Or is it better to to maybe have mom be away at work some of the time. But how old's your daughter?
She's 5.
So she's probably not proud of you yet. But
no. Well, although interesting, it's funny because like she didn't quite, you know, understand what I do for a living. And she still hasn't even, you know, really seen me. She hasn't seen me do stand up. She saw me in a TV show recently and that was cute. Cause she went up to the TV and like hugged the television or whatever.
Oh,
like,
my God.
Fun. I was doing stand up in Philadelphia and I took her. My husband and daughter came just like we had like a night away and I took her to the theater just so she can see the theater and not to see the stand-up because I was obviously way too adult for her.
Not appropriate.
But she saw the poster outside. My face was on the poster and she pulled, she turned to the security guard that was standing and she said, "Look at the poster. That's my mom. She's a magician." Mm. And I was like, all right, well, don't know why you're trolling me with that, but yeah, not
at
a
least
magician.
She didn't say mime.
Yeah, true. Or clown. That would have been a big insult. No, but I think the interesting thing about like what I was carrying or what I didn't know that I was carrying was really all about like motherhood because I had this, you know. I kept going to this place in Morocco. I took my daughter to Morocco. My husband was on the last season of Homeland, which was shooting in Morocco. He's an actor. And we went to Morocco to visit him when she was a newborn. Mm. And my trip kept sending me to Morocco. I was like, why is this happening? Like, trip, I get it. Morocco, like it was a pleasant memory. It was a nice time. And then then something happened, which my brain had totally suppressed. It had completely suppressed it the day after it happened, which is that I was holding my daughter when she was a newborn. I was standing too close to a kettle and I burned her finger on the kettle. And I was catatonic when that happened, right? Of course, she was fine. But I was like, I beat myself up about it. And then when I came back to New York, I was so anxious all the time that I was going to let go of the stroller. I was going to do something weird. And like, you know, I had to go to my OB and I was like, guys, I'm having like crazy heart palpitation. And it was really like, went back to this moment that I had completely forgotten for 5 years.
Wow.
The mushrooms brought it right back up and was like, you need to forgive yourself for that moment, you know, because I think in some ways it was just like cascading under the surface and constantly ruining me.
Yeah. Isn't it amazing how those things from our unconscious can just be running the show and we don't even know? That's so amazing that the mushrooms was like pointing at that. Like,
yes,
it's almost magic. Oh, magic mushrooms. Sorry. I don't mean to be such an idiot. Just connected those dots. But it is magic in its own crazy way.
It is. Because the other fascinating thing that a brain does with like a little traumatic moments, big and small, is that it suppresses the memory so that you can move on, right?
Right.
And so it's weird that it is magical that it was able to, you know, resurrect a memory that my brain had actively suppressed. If you would ask me about Morocco, I would have told you a million other things and I would never have remembered that.
Right. Right. But that was clearly what you were there to work out on that trip. That is so amazing. One thing that you said in the article was that what struck you was how much love was in every trip for every person who was participating.
Yeah.
What made you realize that?
You know, everyone had these unanswered questions about their family, about their siblings, about their parents. And there was this like, and everyone was like in pain about it in like this way of like, you know, I hope my mom knew that I like loved her, or, you know, I hope my mom understands that I didn't mean this or didn't mean that, or, you know, memories with siblings. And everyone was so concerned, and just there was just so much pain and love, which are like, you know, two sides of the same coin, that were intertwined in everyone's trips. And it was really fascinating to see that. And that, and it was one of those moments where you're like, again, we were like mixed race group, intergenerational group. Everyone had different careers. It was a, you know, a wildly different group. And yet everyone had the same kind of like core set of concerns and pains, you know, concerns about their kids, concerns about their parents, concerns about their relatives in whatever way. Every trip was sort of like about these relationships. And it was really striking to me that if you put a bunch of different people, like I have the visions of putting a MAGA Trump Republican next to, you know, Gwyneth Paltrow or something, and they become best friends through magic mushrooms, because you do see the essential humanity in everyone. It's so dorky, but it's true. And that was really striking to me, and hearing everybody, being able to like witness everybody's stories.
That's really gorgeous. I mean, okay, so we're formulating a plan for healing the nation. we're all going to go to Jamaica. you said that the research says that after you have this kind of intense psychedelic experience, that you have 6 to 8 weeks of neuroplasticity after you have a therapeutic dose of psilocybin. So yeah, that means your brain can accept change.
Yes.
Which is so interesting to me. How did it ripple out in your life in the subsequent months?
Well, I want to, I'll tell you that in a second, but I want to say the last thing that I got rid of, which I think then enabled me to have those like 6 to 8 weeks of like successful neuroplasticity, which was that like I had been talking about my birth, like the delivery of my child here and there, just I would mention it offhandedly. Mm. And a therapist asked me if I had a traumatic delivery. And I said, oh yeah. And I did. I have, you know, I had a very tough delivery, and ended in a C-section. The C-section lasted over 2 hours, and like whatever. Mm. So there was a lot that went on in this really long, drawn out process that was extraordinarily painful and physically painful, just straight up torture. And I said to her, yeah, I did. I had a traumatic delivery, but like, it's not a big deal. I've worked it out. I have 15 minutes of stand up about it. So we're good. we dealt with it.
Yeah, totally processed. I'm just going to repeat the same jokes about it over and over again until the bit gets stale and it's not getting laughs anymore. My God. Yeah, amazing. Yeah.
And she was like, okay, well, you know, it's just something to think about, whatever, you know? And I was like, okay. And then in the third trip, at the very beginning of the trip, I find myself in the delivery room, and I had to re-experience my entire painful, miserable delivery.
Wow.
And the funny thing is, like, for me, it was that I didn't take the epidural for 17 hours because they, you know, there's all the stuff they tell you don't take it because it'll elongate the pregnant, whatever, blah, blah, blah. And so I was like trying to be a good student.
It's moralizing too. The epidural thing is like such a like moral judgment.
Totally. And I was like trying to be a good student of having a baby, and but my cervix wouldn't open, and cervici are supposed to sort of swing open, the baby comes through, mine wouldn't do that, and they tried all sorts of like, you know, medieval torture devices, like throwing them in there to try and get that shit to open. It wouldn't do it. And then ultimately, after 17 hours of that, I got the epidural, and then the epidural wasn't like totally, didn't totally work. So then another 8 or 9 hours of this epidural being crazy. Anyway, so it was torture, but part of the thing that it was really traumatic. And then part of the thing that was happening for me was that I have like a really high pain threshold, as is evidenced by being a comedian. And I didn't tell, like, the nurses would be like, do you want an epidural now? And I'd be like, no, just you keep torturing me and this is fine. You know what I mean? And I, because I could just handle the pain. It doesn't mean the pain feels any better on someone like me. It just means I can like handle it for whatever reason. And when I was back in the delivery room in my trip, I said to the therapist who had asked me about the thing, I said, can you just tell her to give me the epidural? Can you just tell her to give me the epidural? And the therapist came over and she said, well, you know what, Nagin? And she played into the scene and she's like, you know, the nurse is standing right here. Why don't you tell her that you want the epidural? And so
you role played reliving this traumatic experience so you could ask for what you needed.
Yes. And that is something they do in therapy when they basically want you to rewrite the scene the way that it should have gone for you, to kind of defang the memory of its heinousness. And so we did that. And I kept saying, you know, like they didn't know I was in that much pain. And so, and I literally in the moment, like forgave all of the nurses and doctors, and I forgave myself for not asking for what I wanted. And after I did all of that, that's when I was just in a euphoric state, which is the only good time I had during the trips was that. Is like I was just like this cocky, like victor of a war, like a Napoleon Bonaparte, had just conquered some shit. And I was so happy. And I took the mask off and I saw the trees turn into claymation or whatever. And like, I was, you know, I was really, really elated at like the weight had been lifted. And I didn't know that you could carry the pain of a traumatic birth for 4 to 6 years. And so I do feel like that was weighing me down very much. But I had acted like, no, it's fine. I'm fine. Everything's fine. But I wasn't fine. That thing had weighed me down and I finally was able to let go of it.
God, what a gift.
Yes.
What a gift that you took this thing as a gig really, and you're like, yeah, I'm going to go see if this is some bullshit. And then you're like, oh my God. Like, wow. It's so powerful. It's such a testament like good therapeutic practices and people who took good care of you and knew what they were doing. And, you know, mine was my psilocybin experience was a little bit more like DIY bang a gong, like, you know, let's talk, let's make a chart about the psyche. Like it was fine. And it was fine.
Right,
and I was
glad
to be taking the risk and living my life and being, you know, willing to go have this experience. But I think if people really want to get the most out of a real therapeutic dose of psilocybin, a real therapeutic experience with psilocybin, it sounds like you had the like Ritz-Carlton of experiences.
Yes. Oh, definitely. Because then the thing, in getting back to your question about the neuroplasticity, because then the thing is, you've done all of this therapeutic work, you've done all of this processing, and what they want is for you to go home and spend 6 to 8 weeks implementing this kind of like new way of thinking and feeling. And because your brain can create new connections, it just has new neural pathway abilities, and it's remarkable. And one of the things that you have is this default mode network, which is the voice in your head that's telling you you're a piece of garbage. That voice shuts down for about 6 to 8 weeks.
Oh my God.
And it's just like hanging out, being cool. Like that's,
wow.
And it's amazing. And I remember like I had to do a show for Wei Wei Don't Tell Me at Tanglewood 3 days after, and in front of 7,000 people.
Wow.
And normally I'll deliver a joke on that show. And this show, it's, you know, it's a very popular show. This is a really huge venue. And so there's like, there can be nerves or whatever involved. And normally like I'll do a joke and they'll be like, Nagin, that fucking sucked. You know what I mean? Like I did the inside of my brain is just shitting on myself about whatever it is I'm saying. Mm. And then, but this time I get on stage, I deliver a joke, and then I just listen at other jokes. And then I do another joke. It was like, and my brain had no comment, and it was remarkable.
Whoa. Whoa.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't know that I've ever experienced my brain having no comment.
It's great. Yeah.
I'm going to go take some mushrooms.
Your brain
needs to
like shut the fuck up. Like, like mostly real, like all of our brains. Now you know what I mean?
Yes.
Like everyone's brain like needs to shut the fuck
Not
up.
Not helpful. Yes. Yeah.
Not yeah. Full, not helpful.
I interviewed a woman named Katie Goodman, who is an improviser, and she wrote a book about improv. Do you know Katie? Yeah. And so she wrote a book about improv and using it to sort of improve your life. And she said her inner critic, you know, she talks back to it by saying, not relevant. Every time it talks to her and gives her one of those like, you suck, those like short, direct statements, she just says not relevant to it. Like we have to find a way to counter program against those negative critical voices in our heads. Otherwise, we cannot be happy.
And after the 6 to 8 weeks, like when the voice in the head starts to kind of like return, I started doing stuff like that where I'd be like, I guess I could fail or I could succeed, right, brain? Okay, let's move on.
Yeah.
So I would just exactly talk back, just as Katie's suggesting, talk back to your head and let it know who's in charge.
That's right. Show it who's boss. I love this conversation. Thank you for being so transparent about your journey and what you unearthed, because that stuff is really personal. I ask everyone on this podcast one question, which is, are there any deal terms in your life that you're currently willing to renegotiate? Has there been anything that's been nagging you that you want to work on or change since you've been back?
It's funny because I mentioned before we got on the call that I'm starting to make a movie and I'm trying to like really bring back in all of the Serena Williams vibes, all of the just, you know, I want to like be able to go forth into another project without having so much doubt and also asking for what I need, stuff that I've made 4 other feature films and I never asked for what I need. I've just made do. I've kind of like made a film despite not having at all the things I need. And
amazing.
And I think I'm trying to, so what I'm working on right now is just being really real about getting into something and being like, in order for me to do this right, this is what I need. And kind of being comfortable saying that out loud to power players, you know?
Yeah. I love that. So you're not just going to accept sort of the crumbs of resources that independent filmmakers often decide they need to accept because they're going to make that movie by hook or by crook. But you're actually going to ask for what it is that you need to make the movie you want to make.
Yeah. I might not even get all the things that I will ask for.
Of course not.
But I think I would stop myself from even asking before because I thought it was like asking for too much. And that kind of thinking I'm trying to do away with.
I don't think Serena Williams everything she's asking for too much.
No, she doesn't.
No, she knows exactly what she needs and she asks for it and she fucking gets it.
Oh. Yeah. And that's what we should all be doing.
Exactly. Thank you for providing such an excellent button to as the comedian that you are, to tie up this episode. I'm so grateful to have had this conversation and to know you a little bit. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you so much. This was so fun. And you can read all about all of that stuff in Afar magazine.
Fantastic. We'll put links to the article and all your social media, TED Talk and everything in the show notes for this podcast. Thanks so much, Nagin.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Hotter Than Ever. If you have been enjoying this podcast, please leave me a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. Your honest feedback about what this podcast means to you means everything to me. It also means a lot to Apple's algorithm. And the more great reviews we have, the more people will be able to find the show. If you are looking for advice, please DM us on Instagram at hotterthaneverpod or call and leave a voicemail or text your question to 323-844-2303. That is 323-844-2303. I give totally unqualified advice from my super opinionated heart and soul right here on the podcast about all the topics we talk about here regularly and probably some more. I would love to answer your question on a future episode. Hotter Than Ever is produced by Erica Gerard and Podkit Productions. Our associate producer is Melody Carey. Music is by Chris Keating with vocals by Issa Fernandez. Come back next week. Drug week will be over. And we will be back to other topics like sex and relationships and various kinds of empowering and, dare I say, feminist subject matter from some unbelievable women who are really blowing my mind with every conversation we have. I feel like I'm learning and I'm growing and I'm changing and I'm evolving. How about you? Are you feeling the same way? God, I fucking hope so. That's why we're here.